listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And the with the lead story in the New York Times this morning, or at least on my phone as I was coming in, was Ukraine all over again. And what's going on there? These group of so-called pro-Russian folks. I say so-called because I don't know the story. I want to ask Stephen Cohen about this in just a moment. Seized a couple of government buildings in a couple of cities, apparently, and then the Ukrainian government sent the troops in and dislodged them, and now there's all this conversation about. In fact, actually, Victoria Jones in the news report here on our program yesterday was saying that, the word that she got from Jay Carney at the White House was that some of these people are, quote, paid provocateurs. And then on the other side, you've got the Russians saying, no, it's Blackwater. And it's like, what's going on here? So the guy who really understands this stuff better than anybody I've ever met in my whole entire life is Professor Stephen Cohen. Professor Emeritus at New York University and Princeton University, contributing editor to The Nation magazine, author of the book Soviet Fates and Lost Alternatives, From Stalinism to the New Cold War. Of course, you can read his work over at thenation.com. His most recent piece is titled Flawed U.S. Policy Led to This New Cold War. And Professor Cohen, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Tom.
Thanks for joining us. This flawed U.S. policy led to this new Cold War. Was this first published in The Nation?
Yeah, actually, the title is a little more lyrical. It's called Cold War Again, Who's Responsible?
Oh, okay.
But it does argue at the core that American policy over the last 20 years has led to this crisis. Not only, but that's been the driving force of this worst crisis with Russia, I think, since the Cuban Missile Crisis. And it's getting worse by the day.
So what is the popular narrative that we're reading in the New York Times and the American press? And what is the popular narrative that is being perceived in Russia, and where does the truth lie between the two?
I'm not sure. I don't know. I mean, part of the problem is, let me back up. The argument that I make in the Nation article is that leading up to, let's say, the annexation of Crimea a couple of weeks ago in March, you had two completely conflicting narratives, the American narrative and the Russian one. The American narrative said all this is about democracy and sovereign choice and economic prosperity and joining Europe. And the Russians don't want any of that, so they did bad things in Ukraine and then they seized Crimea. The Russian narrative is the United States has moved its economic, military, and political power toward Russia over the last 20 years. Since the end of the Soviet Union, spearheaded by NATO expansion, but not only. All these NGOs promoting democracy have been very deeply involved in Ukrainian and Russian politics. And about 10 years ago, Putin said, we don't like any of this, but believe you me, we have two red lines. One is the former Soviet Republic of Georgia, and we, the West, crossed that line, and we had a brief war in 2008. And the other, said Putin, is Ukraine. Now, he thinks we've crossed the line in Ukraine because he believes that all of this, beginning back in November, when the European Union offered Ukraine a so-called economic prosperity or partnership agreement, in which the elected president of Ukraine, Yanukovych, did not sign and was overthrown by protests in the streets, that according to the Russians, all of this is about taking Ukraine out of Russia's realm of influence, where it's been for 300 years, and attaching it not only to Europe, but to NATO. If I had to choose between the two narratives, I would say the Russian narrative is closer to the truth, which will result in me being called a Putin apologist. But for a historian, such as I am, facts are facts. And as Casey Stengel used to say, you could look this up.
Yeah.
It's just absolutely clear. Now, what we have today is the aftermath, don't we? And it's gotten more dangerous. We have all these moving parts. First of all, Washington's not telling the truth. The government in Kiev is not telling the truth. And the Russians aren't telling the whole truth. And we're supposed to figure out where the truth is among them. But it's very, very dangerous because here's what you've got. The Russians have had about nobody knows exactly, 20 to 40,000 troops on the eastern border, on its western border with eastern Ukraine. They've been there about a month. And there are various accounts of whether they're in a menacing operational posture or they're not. But they're there. Meanwhile, there is a lot of talk and maybe some reality already of moving NATO troops, which had not been forward-based east of Berlin, east of Germany, toward Russia, to the Baltics, to Romania, to Poland, and possibly to western Ukraine, which would be a catastrophe. Now, while all that's going on, you suddenly have secessionist, pro-Russian secessionist movements seizing municipal legislatures in four or five large cities in eastern Ukraine, pro-Russian.
Right along the Ukrainian-Russian border, more
or less. That's exactly right. Donetsk and the others. Now, the White House says, this isn't authentic. This isn't really locals there. These are paid Russian agents. And the Russians are answering, well, Kiev is sending troops to take back the buildings, and traveling with them are these American mercenary, who used to be called Blackwater, now it's called Greystone or something. And meanwhile, everybody's wearing a black mask. You can see them on TV. It's not a good sign when toughs are running around in masks, don't want their face to be shown. So you've got a lot of tails wagging the dog being the potential of war with Russia, a lot of tripwires. And the puzzlement to me is the Russians have made what I think is a reasonable set of proposals for the beginning of negotiation. By beginning of negotiation, it means we compromise, they compromise, and all the rest. But for some reason, publicly, the White House has not accepted that invitation to sit down and negotiate. Now, they may be doing it secretly, Tom. We never know the full story. And if they are negotiating secretly, good. But the way Kerry spoke today, really, I think, unbefitting to a Secretary of State, calling the Russians liars and provocateurs, and yet he wants to go and talk to the Russian foreign minister. It doesn't look like the Obama administration is in a negotiating mode, though it says it is on one level.
Mm-hmm. Now, when Victoria first, she's a reporter with Talk Radio News Service and comes on every day and just gives us a, you know, and she was at the White House, and was sharing the story with me yesterday. And the view was, it looks like maybe Russia is going to grab some more territory from Ukraine. And my response was, and this is based on, you know, no insights like you have, just kind of common sense, I think. Russia had, you know, a major chunk of their fleet in Crimea. It's a strategic, militarily and strategically, it is critical to them. And so seizing that makes sense, or collaborating with the folks there to you know, do the separation or whatever.
Right.
But taking any more of Ukraine doesn't make sense to me. It seems more like a provocation. It almost seems like this is internal Ukrainian politics that is going to spill out over into Russia and into NATO.
Well, you've made a fundamentally smart point that doesn't emit from Washington. Not all of this, but the situation that's been created by the European Union's move on Ukraine back in November that triggered all of this, it's now being driven, you're absolutely right, by internal Ukrainian realities. Put it like this. Back in November, there was one Ukrainian state. But there were at least two Ukrainian countries. The state was never stable.
Right.
And now the state has basically fallen apart. And you have a kind of de facto at the moment partitioning of Ukraine. One half leaning to Russia, one half to Europe. So the question is, what should be done now?
Well, let's pick that up in just a second. We're talking with Professor Stephen Cohen, writing for The Nation magazine.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You can read his most recent article over at thenation.com. We'll be right back with more Dr. Cohen. So, Dr. Cohen, kind of fundamental to my analysis of this was the assumption that Russia had and needed Crimea.
Yeah.
Had a legitimate strategic military interest and needed Crimea. and that probably not only did they not have a legitimate need for the rest of Ukraine other than as a neutral buffer zone, but that taking over more of it or nibbling away cities would just be a mess for Putin. Does that analysis?
Well, I think that's absolutely right. I would go farther about Crimea. Crimea's attachment to Russia is not only military, it's emotional, historical, political. It was always in Russia. And it was a kind of administrative fluke that during the Soviet era, Khrushchev said, you know, let's just put it in Ukraine. Nobody ever thought Ukraine would be apart from Russia. But Crimea and its history is kind of like the Alamo to us. It'd be like we gave the Alamo back or something.
Right.
I mean, it just evokes all these historical myths, many of them military, not only, but about glory. But look, let's stop and think. Putin was being pushed hard at home to bring Crimea into the Russian Federation. And the argument was it is in the Russian Federation. It's only kind of flukily, administratively, it's in Ukraine. Bring it in. It protects our fleet. God knows what's going to happen as a result of this revolution or whatever in Kiev. But what's being argued here in the United States now that he has a larger ambition, which is to take the whole of eastern Ukraine, that is not the goal in Moscow. But if it comes to it, they will do it. If they're pushed, they're not in a retreating, compromising mood. They feel they've been come at by us for 20 years. But stop and think. Putin understands, I think, as well as you and I do, that if Russian troops enter eastern Ukraine, NATO troops will probably enter western Ukraine. Stop and think of what that means. That is like the Cuban Missile Crisis. They're eyeball to eyeball, nobody in a mode to blink. And it could come to war. Putin has no interest in that. It's the last thing in the world he would want. Therefore, what he wants is stability. And the Russians have put forward a proposal that they think will stabilize Ukraine. I don't know if it will or it won't, but it's worth discussing. And the crucial point goes back to what you said before, that this is now being driven by internal conflicts in Ukraine. The Russians are saying that in such a divided country, divided historically, politically, religiously, economically, ethnically, linguistically, every conceivable division. You need a federal constitution, not a unitary constitution. For example, at the moment, all the governors are appointed by the central government in Kiev. They're not elected locally or regionally. The Russians are saying you'll never have unity like this. So we have to have, and they even point to the United States. They don't understand our union very well.
Right, but they know how different the South is from Boston.
That's right. But, I mean, yeah. they kind of don't have an idea of all the problems. After we fought a civil war to keep the union together. These are not easy to do. Yeah. But the point is, they're saying, look, the United States has a union, and they give the states elect their governors, and they have some tax authority, and et cetera, et cetera. That's right. What Ukraine needs. Should have.
Okay, let's pick this up right after the break. It'll just be a second. Professor Stephen Cohen is with us. Professor Emeritus at New York University and Princeton University contributing editor to The Nation magazine, thenation.com. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Dr. Stephen Cohen, Professor Stephen Cohen on the line with us. His new piece in The Nation about how our flawed policy led to the new Cold War. I'm sorry, I don't have the original article in front of me, so I don't have the correct title. What is the title?
It's called Cold War Again, Who's Responsible?
Great, thank you. And you can read it over at thenation.com, of course. And you were saying that, first of all, that now Ukraine is kind of two countries, one, and two, that President Putin has proposed a sort of federalist constitution for Ukraine, where are we at in this, and do you want to elaborate on those before you continue?
Well, I mean, Americans know the difference between a unitary state, that is where all power is vested in the central government, and a federal or a union state where the components, whether we call them precepts or regions or states, they have their own power.
Yeah, I think most Americans don't understand that distinction.
Well, but we have a Supreme Court that sorts this out periodically.
Yeah.
But we've
yeah.
lived with it all our lives,
sure.
our history. And the Russians are saying Ukraine is so badly divided that if you want to keep it one Ukraine, you need to move in that direction. Now, the Russophobic lobby in Washington is saying it's a trick, because what the Russians want to do is give the eastern pro-Russian provinces of Ukraine something akin to autonomy, so they can live by the rules of Russia and not by the rules of Kiev, the central government.
Right.
But here's the thing, Tom. You and I know this. Just because bad people sometimes associate themselves with a good idea doesn't mean the idea is bad. There are people in Russia who see in this idea of a federative Ukraine a chance to reassert Russia's authority over the whole of Ukraine. But other Russians don't see it like that. And many Ukrainians agree that you're going to need a federative Ukraine if you're going to remain a single state. But that raises another question. If that doesn't work, and the only alternative is war, civil war or war between East and West, then the third option is a partitioned Ukraine, two Ukrainian states. Now, that is discussed kind of secretly, like some kind of forbidden drug. But it is being discussed in Europe, I would assume in Washington, if anybody's awake there, and certainly in Moscow. Would that be the worst outcome? Because what you'd end up with is a Western Ukraine that would return from whence it came, Lithuania, Poland, and those regions of Eastern Europe.
Right.
And Eastern Ukraine would return where it lived for 300 years to Russia. Would that be stability? Would everybody be satisfied with half? Would Ukrainians themselves accept that? I don't know, but I mean, it's better than war.
And would Kiev end up like a divided city like Jerusalem?
Interesting, because one of the objections to this is when you hit central Ukraine, it's such a mishmash of ethnicity that nobody would know where to draw the borders.
Right.
But there are that would be a negotiation and compromise. Economics are very important here. Eastern Ukraine is completely embedded in the Russian economy. It's where the heavy industry, the military-industrial complex is. Space components are made there. People say, well, that's why Russia wants to keep it. That's so. But where is Ukraine going to sell that stuff to if they don't sell it to Russia? There's no market for that other than Russia. So Eastern Ukraine and Russia are linked fundamentally by economics. And I haven't even mentioned, Tom, the most poignant part of this. There are tens of millions of mixed Ukrainian-Russian marriages.
Mm.
I mean, this is conjugal, so to speak. It's not only political and economic.
Right.
But, I mean, families are caught in this horrible, and they don't understand why they have to get a visa to go to Russia or to come to Ukraine. And the truth is they shouldn't have to.
Yeah.
So this is really a profound crisis driven by historical divisions and provoked, I believe, by unwise European, American attempts to draw Ukraine to NATO. I think that was the underlying motive. Mm. And it's led to this.
Yeah. So
there is a way out. I mean, the point is there's a way out. I mean, and the Russian proposals are somewhat more complicated than I mentioned, but I think Russia would even be willing, that's just my guess, based on some things, that if there was a fair settlement to their mind, they'd allow Crimea, though it would remain in the Russian Federation, to have special economic relations with the mainland, because Crimea is a peninsula,
mm-hmm.
have economic relations with the mainland of Ukraine, and a visa-free regime, maybe a tax-free regime. I mean, I don't think it's in their interest to isolate Crimea completely from Ukraine. But at the moment, everybody's so angry, and it's been so militarized, that the diplomacy needed seems not to be there.
What, if from an American point of view, what, or even from a world citizen point of view, the risk of war mm-hmm. going beyond Ukraine?
Yeah.
We've had this conversation before. Are we at a World War One moment? Has the clock gotten closer to midnight or farther away? We have just a minute left.
I think we're ticking toward midnight, and I think there's even a worse scenario. The Russian army is in much better shape now than it was 10 years ago. But NATO has the conventional advantage, and Russia has said it would use tactical nuclear weapons if it was threatened. And I do not take that as an idle boast. We in the United States States do not have a no-first nuclear strike doctrine. We've never adopted that. The Russians had one once. But they're now saying that if they're overrun by conventional forces, they will resort to the unthinkable. I don't think we want to mess with this. I really don't.
Wow. This is like the monkey that's got his hand in the jar and doesn't want to let go of the peanuts, you know.
Or some body part.
Yeah. Yeah. We just, we had to back away from this thing. This is...
It's too bad that the American media, which is good on a lot of things, has such a phobia about Russia and Putin that they really can't tell two sides to the story. That's all they need to do is just tell both sides.
Well, that's why I wanted to have this conversation with you, because there's so much jingoism going on. Dr. Stephen Cohen, you can read his new piece over at thenation.com. Sir, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks, Tom.
It's always great talking. It's always an honor. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Professor Cohen's work is over at thenation.com. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Professor Cohen, back to writing about Russia and Ukraine. This just concerns me tremendously. I don't know how to say it beyond that. Anyway, and it's interesting. We do a TV show, and we have a co-production agreement with RT, which has been widely maligned in the press, to say the least. But our contract gives us absolute editorial independence, and the people who do all the content for the show are my employees, and it's my show. So I'm working around mostly Americans, but there's a few Russians there who are fairly knowledgeable about this stuff, but not much of an opportunity to get into these kind of conversations. I mean, it's almost like everybody's... everybody's busy mostly, but I don't have any inside, people think, you're over at RT every day. You must have some inside information. No, I don't. I really don't know, the Russian view on this any better than I know the American view. But Professor Cohen does, and we will continue to have him on as long as he'll come on. I think he's one of the smartest guys in the room right now, in the country, maybe in the world, one of the most rational voices. Anyhow, meanwhile, the state of Maryland is going green. And by green, I'm talking about on Monday, the state Senate passed by a margin of 34-8 a bill that would decriminalize marijuana in the old line state. Now, this isn't the total Colorado, Washington state. Hey, it's cool. This just, reduces it down to less of a penalty. But Governor Art O'Malley, who might be thinking of running for president in 2016 as a Democrat, he's the governor of Maryland, he says he's going to sign the bill. In fact, he said, as a young prosecutor, I once thought that decriminalizing the possession of marijuana might undermine the public will necessary to combat drug violence. I now think that it is an acknowledgement of the low priority that our courts, our prosecutors, our police, and the vast majority of citizens already attach to this transgression of public order and public health. So he's still calling it a transgression of public order and public health, but basically, like most Americans, he's changed his mind about pot. In fact, according to an October Gallup poll, a record number of Americans, 58%, now support full legalization of pot, whereas just 10 years ago, 64% opposed full legalization. And O'Malley isn't even going the whole full legalization route. He's just decriminalizing. So these changing opinions have translated into changing laws. Once Governor O'Malley signs Maryland's decriminalization bill, the old line state will join the 24 other states that have either decriminalized marijuana, okayed it for medical use, or in the case of Colorado, Washington state, legalized it altogether. Our mayor here in Washington, D.C. last Friday signed a decriminalization bill, taking it down to a $25 fine. I think Maryland's going to keep it at like $100 or something like that. But as Bob Dylan once said, the times, they are changing. Of course, not everyone is okay with the sudden shift. Just down the road from Maryland here in Washington, D.C., the head of the department, the Drug Enforcement Agency, the DEA, Michelle Leonhardt, is fighting decriminalization tooth and nail. She's a Bush appointee, a leftover, and I continually scratch my head when I'm, you know, here we are 6 years into the Obama administration, and he's still got Bush appointees, and she's one of the biggest supporters of Nixon's failed war on drugs. In fact, she's such a hardliner that when Congressman Jared Polis asked her a few years ago whether pot, hang on just a second, sorry about that, whether pot was more or less dangerous than heroin or crack cocaine, she couldn't give an answer. And 2 years later, she's sticking to her guns, although she's changed her story, her rationale just a little bit. She told the House of Representatives last week that the wave of decriminalization laws sweeping the nation has not discouraged the DEA one bit. In fact, she says they just make the agency want to fight harder. Fight against what? Well, apparently, according to the head of the DEA, fight against the plague of stoned dogs that's sweeping the nation. No, seriously. After saying that she wanted to keep on fighting the good fight against stoners, like people, Leonhardt told Congress that she was worried about how lax marijuana policy was affecting America's pet population. I'm not making this up. Here's the absolute verbatim quote. Quote from the head of the DEA, Michelle Leonhardt, George Bush appointee. Quote, there was just an article last week, and it was on pets. It was about the unanticipated or unexpected consequences of marijuana legalization in Washington, Colorado, and how veterinarians now are seeing dogs come in, their pets come in, and being treated because they've been exposed to marijuana. Again, it goes back to the edibles. It goes back to products that are in the household that are now made from marijuana, and it's impacting pets. End of quote. Yep, that's right. The woman in charge of drug enforcement policy for the United States of America is worried that if we further legalize or decriminalize pot, our dogs are going to get the spins. I mean, this is just embarrassing. It should be common knowledge by now that not only is marijuana not dangerous, it's actually way safer than alcohol. Alcohol, which is legal, kills about 40,000 people a year. Smoking marijuana has never killed anyone. Well, there was that guy a couple of weeks ago who fell off the roof of a house or something. But, I mean, come on. You've never heard of a drunk falling off a roof? As we move closer and closer to legal marijuana, we need policymakers who actually understand what marijuana is and what its effects are. And frankly, in my opinion, who have smoked it at least once in their lives. I have no idea why Obama left this woman in charge of the DEA after George W. Bush left office. But it is time for him to ask for her resignation. She is just harshing America's mellow. She is, you know, it's like, that's it. So anyway, the Progressive Democrats of America, Tim Carpenter's been on the program many times. PDA is having their 10th anniversary party. I'm going to be there. Jim Hightower is going to be there. Bernie Sanders is going to be there. John Nichols is going to be there. Tim Carpenter is going to be there. Medea Benjamin is going to be there. Tom Hayden is going to be there. We're going to have a good time. It's going to be in Northampton, Massachusetts, which is where Tim lives. And it's going to be on Saturday, May 10th. So if you want to sign and you know, you can buy a ticket to show up and hang out. It's not a whole lot, and it's a contribution to PDA. Mimi Kennedy is going to be there. Couple faces here I don't recognize. One of them looks like a member of Congress, but I'm not going to say for sure. And like I said, Bernie. So you go over to pdamerica.org And A, you can buy a ticket and show up. You can join us, join me and everybody else, May 10th, Saturday, May 10th. It's at the First Churches of Northampton, 129 Main Street. And you can also sign this petition. We're trying to get 10,000 signatures to hand to Bernie on May 10th, you know, when this thing happens, which is just like a month from now, isn't it? Yeah, it's April 8th, so we've got 4 weeks here. We've got, I think, 5,000 or 6,000 signatures. But so if you can get over to pdamerica.org and sign this petition, you don't have to buy anything for that. Because we need Bernie's voice out there. We need Bernie's voice out there. So, anyway, there's a few other things. I want to get into how Walmart is supporting raising food benefits, food stamps. Why? Because they make so much money on food stamps. It's their business model. And how America is basically sliding into, like, we're 70th in the world in health, 39th in basic education, 69th in ecosystem sustainability, 34th in the world in access to water and sanitation, 31st in personal safety. Mexico is ahead of us in satisfaction with life, quality of life, happiness. I mean, we've got Slovenia ahead of us in health. What are the, you know, here's an interesting stat. The number one country in the world in social progress is New Zealand, but they're only 25th in GDP per capita. So they're not that rich, right? They get beat out by Switzerland, Iceland, the Netherlands, Norway, Sweden, Canada, Finland, Denmark, and Australia, but people are happier. What are they doing? Well, you know, they've got a really strong social safety net. Everybody has health care. College is pretty much free. In terms of happiness, we rank 17th behind Mexico. And all of this, I mean, none of this was the case in 1980. In 1980, we were at the top of all those various piles, or within the top 5 or 10. What has happened? 34 years of Reaganomics. It's time to say this Reaganomics experiment was a mistake and a disaster, and time to reverse it.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
With John Boehner and Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell and all the old Reagan warriors out to pasture, and, you know, let's get active for the 2014 election. Welcome back. Kathy in Etna, Wyoming, watching Free Speech TV. Hey, Kathy, thanks for watching. What's up?
Hey, Tom. I wanted to give you my take on why I think America's so interested in Ukraine.
Sure.
It was like 3 weeks ago or so, Senator Menendez from New Jersey, if I'm not mistaken, was chairing a committee, and I think it was about aid to Ukraine. And there was a lot of discussion with people regarding natural gas. And in particular, our Senator Brasso was really pushing for an amendment to go along with whatever bill it was that they were actually trying to pass or to get going, was regarding liquid natural gas.
Mm-hmm.
And he basically, they poo-pooed his liquid natural gas plea because something to do with Turkey, it would cause a lot of friction with Turkey because this is such an explosive product that getting it to Ukraine could really bring up some red flags with Turkey, and so they decided not to go with that amendment. But it's, and I've watched a few things since then, and it seems like there really is a big push for natural gas and or liquid natural gas to go to Ukraine. And they also produced a map of Europe, and Ukraine seemed to have a whole lot of pipelines within its country versus the rest of Europe.
Yeah, about 15% of Europe, about 15% of Europe's natural gas comes from Russia via pipelines across Ukraine. And number one, number two, in November of last year, Chevron signed a $10 billion deal with the Ukrainian government to frack natural gas in Ukraine. And Ukraine had not been a producer of energy up until now, but they've got apparently tar sands, or not shale, you know, gas shale, like we have up in North Dakota. And so the central part of Ukraine is, they're going to start fracking there, and they might be able to produce natural gas and turn that area into like Saudi Arabia or like North Dakota, you know, just a boom town. And and it's an American gas, you know, oil company. And the Europeans are looking at that. We're looking at that. Turkey's involved in transporting, and I'd have to have a map in front of me to remember exactly how it works, but we've got pipelines going across Turkey that's getting gas to Europe also. And so there's like this competition for who's getting, you know, who's transporting the gas from where. The Turkish pipelines across Turkey, I believe, are coming from Saudi Arabia. And it might be oil instead of gas, but the so, you know, the politics start getting very complex. But you're right on the money that one of the big pivot points for all of this stuff is fossil fuels.
Okay.
So,
well, that's my two cents.
Yeah. Well, that and that's mine too. And it's you know, if we could help the world very, very quickly move away from using fossil fuels and start using solar energy, and, you know, go from ancient sunlight to contemporary sunlight, a lot of this stuff would become nonsense. Kathy, thank you for the call, and thanks for watching. But, you know, we haven't done that. And Chevron is going to be, you know, assuming everything continues, Chevron is going to be fracking Ukraine. And if Ukraine divides, then the question is, where is that Marcellus shale, you know, that they can frack the gas out of? And frankly, I don't know the answer to that one. And it's a very, very messy situation. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Howard in Coriopolis, Pennsylvania. Hey, Howard, what's up?
Yes, Tom. I am 72 years old. And I can recall the history of the Cold War, and I can recall when I think it was Gorbachev. There was a word called perestroika.
Perestroika, yeah. And he cut a deal with George Herbert Walker Bush to break up the Soviet Union, with the agreement by Bush. Bush, the president, the elder. Reagan gets credit for this, but this all happened after Reagan had left office. With the agreement of Bush that we would not move NATO into any of those countries that were along that you know, Estonia, Lithuania, Latvia, Poland, or Ukraine, any of those countries that were close to or bordering Russia. And we have violated that agreement.
Well, my point is this, is I remember when Yeltsin, he stood in front of that tank.
Yeah.
There was election, and he became the president.
Yep.
And hello?
Yeah, no, I'm here. I'm listening.
I felt like Russia was trying to reach out to us and, you know,
they
wanted
were
to be an ally of our country.
Yeah, they
and,
were.
And so all of this here problems we're having now could have been avoided if we would have brought Russia into, I don't know, not a member of the European Union, but to be an ally of America, not an enemy. But you know what? I am suspicious that the Pentagon always has to have an enemy. And I feel I could smell a rat, that they needed Russia to continue to be an enemy.
Yeah, I don't think it's so much the Pentagon necessarily as it is just basically the neocons, you know, the old PNAC crowd, the old Project for New American Century. They've reinvented themselves. They're out there doing the Russia bashing. You know, they were doing the bomb Iran stuff. They were doing the bomb Syria stuff. They want war. These people just want war. And I agree with you. There, you know, there was a very serious effort to bring our countries together between Gorbachev and Bush, and prior to that, between Gorbachev and Reagan, and then Yeltsin. And then I was actually in Russia. I was in the region that Kaliningrad. I was in Kaliningrad the week of the first genuine Russian election, and which was an amazing experience. And the Soviet Union had just, you know, collapsed in that previous year. This was 91, 92. And There was all this hope. And then all these guys from the Chicago School went over there, these economic advisors, and said, you got to just, you know, totally dismantle the entire social welfare state here in the former Soviet Union in Russia and throw people out on the streets. And Louise and I, a year or two later, traveled through those Baltic states. We went, we flew into Germany, took a train to Poland, to Warsaw, and then went up the coast, you know, through Latvia, Lithuania, Vilnius and Riga and Estonia, Tallinn, and our daughter had been staying up in Denmark, so we took the ferry over and picked her up. And all the way there in all these major cities, they were just starting to, you know, have commercial enterprises, and they were also just starting to have streets filled with homeless people and beggars and children and poverty, something that they'd never had, something that they'd never seen, homelessness they'd never seen before, and or at least not since World War II. And it was the Chicago Boys. It was shock therapy. It's Naomi Klein chronicles it in her book on that, on shock therapy. And it got done to Russia, too, and that led to the rise of the oligarchs. And I think that that's one of the biggest problems they have. So, anyhow, Howard, thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for your perspective. Sherry in Frankfort, Illinois. Hey, Sherry, what's up?
Hi, Tom. How are you? I'm one of your biggest fans. I'm retired. I wait till 2 o'clock every day and turn you on.
Thank you.
Anyway, yesterday I was listening to Professor Kay.
Yeah, Harvey Kay.
Yeah, you and him were talking about... One thing you started mentioning was how, you know, kind of we oftentimes on the left look for some kind of a messiah that's going to come and save us. So I think we all hoped Obama would, you know, represent our cause, and we've been disappointed by that. And, you know, I think a few years ago we had things like Move On and Occupy, and they didn't really satisfy us very much. You know what I'm saying? As far as a call to action, because you talked about a call for revolution.
Mm-hmm.
And I just felt like, you know, we missed the boat back around the time that the Tea Party came about, because the right wing, you know, used that whole desire for revolution as their theme for, you know, the Tea Party.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just think that somehow, you know, we didn't tap into that, but they did. They got the idea, and of course they had more money and all that to spend. But I just always think that the Democratic Party just, I don't know, there's, everybody says this, but it's true that, you know, they tend to be wishy-washy and they don't want to be a little more, you know, kind of more political theater, I guess is what
yeah.
we need.
Yeah, you know? We need a lot more political theater. And you know, part of the problem is inside the Democratic Party. A much larger part of the problem, frankly, is in the media. You know, the Sunday news shows, you know, Meet the Press, Face the Nation, all this stuff. Back when Bush was in office, they constantly had more than 50% Republicans, and sometimes more, well over 50%. And when confronted by groups like Media Matters about that, they said, "Well, you know, you've got a Republican administration, so of course you're going to have a lot of Republicans on." And then Obama becomes president, and they continue to have majority Republicans. And when they do get Democrats on, they tend not to be progressive Democrats. Progressive Democrats are virtually invisible in the media in the United States. And yet the positions of progressive Democrats, of strengthening Social Security, of strengthening Medicare, of you know, making the government the employer of last resort, of going to a single-payer national health care system, you know, these raising taxes on the very rich, raising taxes on corporations so they pay their fair share, you know, not letting them stash money overseas, changing our trade policy back to a protective trade policy. These are the policies that the vast majority, well over 70 to 80, in some cases 90% of Americans agree with and support, and you will never hear those voices, or only very rarely hear those voices on network television. And that's a tragedy. And it's not because the Democratic Party doesn't have those people in it. So, Sherry, thank you for the call.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com, America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com, Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. And boy, what a time. You know, we live in an extraordinary moment in history. We are witnessing, it must be, Dmitry Orlov was on our program a couple of years ago. Wrote a great book. I think it's called Deconstructing Collapse or something about collapse. It was about the collapse of the Soviet Union. He was a Russian. He was there when the Soviet Union fell apart. Now lives in the United States. And he in fact, he has a blog, which I think is DmitryOrlov.com. But, you know, what got me thinking about this is that, you know, he lived through and saw the collapse of the Soviet Union. We are living through and seeing the collapse of the American Union. I mean, it's really a remarkable thing. We are right in front of us. We are watching. Well, for example, since the economic crash 6 years ago, in those 6 years, the United States has increased its net worth. In other words, this country has added $34 trillion in wealth. Now, you divide $34 trillion by the roughly 340 million Americans, and I'm talking not just, you know, people of working age, but literally every man, woman, and child in this country, and that's $100,000 per person. We have become, and this isn't government wealth, this is personal wealth. We've become $34 trillion richer since 2008. $100,000 for every man, woman, and child in America. Did you get your share of it? No? Well, that's because all of it went to the top 7% of Americans. Most of it went to the top 1/10 of 1% of Americans. That's not sustainable. This is not a sustainable system. Reaganomics, the Hayek Austrian School economics, libertarian economics, Republican economics, austerity economics, sequesternomics, whatever you want to call it. Trickle down economics, supply side economics. It is all what George Herbert Walker Bush in the primaries to the 1980 election called voodoo economics. It's voodoo. I mean, it's not actually voodoo has a long history and a good reputation among people who are familiar with it. You know, there are people who are scholars of voodoo. There are books written on voodoo. There are people who practice voodoo. There are people who believe in voodoo. There are people who you know, there's an actual epistemology to voodoo that has a certain amount of predictability associated with it. This economics isn't even voodoo. It gives voodoo a bad name. And we're still taking these people seriously? I mean, Paul Ryan is still going on national television programs and saying, "Oh, yeah, I think we need to voucherize Medicare." Sure, yeah, let's do that. Let's take that, you know, 2/3 of Americans over 65 who depend on Medicare and Social Security for 100% of their income and just tell them, "Here's $7,000. Good luck. Buy insurance. See you later. Don't get sick. If you do, die quick." What kind of fool would even put that stuff on the air, much less propose it. Now, Paul Ryan feels free to propose it because he knows it's never going to happen. First of all, the American people wouldn't stand for it. And secondly, the Democratic Party is going to prevent it. You know, it's just there's always going to be enough Democrats someplace that, you know, but maybe he can whittle away at it a little bit more so that the taxes on the really rich can go down a little bit more, so that the taxes on the working people can go up a little bit more. Keep it. Remember, I mean, one of the first things Reagan did when he became president was he doubled the payroll tax on people making less than $40,000 a year. It's now $117,000 a year, but he doubled that payroll tax. Meanwhile, he cut the top tax rate from 74% down to 18%. Was it 18%? No, it was 28%, excuse me, down to 28%. It has crept back up to 39%. But as long as it's below 50%, we are going to have an unstable boom and bust economy. Now, why, you may say, would these people do this? Why would Steve Moore and Ronald Reagan and George Will and these thoughtful conservatives, why would they advocate these kinds of, but Paul Ryan and John Boehner and Eric Cantor and Mitch McConnell, and, you know, why? Well, there's two really simple answers. A, you've got some really cranky billionaires at the very top who the Supreme Court has basically put in charge of our political process who are mentally ill. Now, I'm not saying all of them are. In fact, probably most of them are not. I know a couple of billionaires myself. I'm not good buddies with them, but I've met them. I know, you know, it's like they're not crazy people. But there are a few who have obsessive compulsive disorder around their money. They are the people who, if they didn't have $1 billion, if their daddy hadn't been rich, or if they hadn't come up with a brilliant idea and invented something, they would instead have an apartment that is filled floor to ceiling with newspapers that you have to navigate through, and they'd be on TV as in the Hoarder show. Or they'd have 38 cats. This is a variation on obsessive compulsive disorder. It's called the hoarding syndrome, and what they're hoarding is money. And they will do anything to get more money. There's never enough. For hoarders, there is never enough. So, A, you've got some people who are mentally ill, and they have enough money to buy politicians, and the politicians then have to dance to their tune. So that's part of it. And then the other part of it is the old-fashioned conservative, and now I'm talking about the real conservatives, the policy conservatives, the William F. Buckley conservatives, the Barry Goldwater conservatives, the Russell Kirk conservatives, the George Will conservatives, who ever since Sir Edmund Burke, I mean, since the American Revolution, have been telling us that having a healthy, unafraid middle class is a dangerous thing. Because the middle class will always want more. So if you want to have a stable society, and the essence of the conservative philosophy is stability, if you want to have a stable society, you have to keep people in bondage. And the best way to do that is debt. Keep them poor, keep them struggling, and they will not rise up against you, and they will do what you want, and you can just, you know, have your nice little luxury life, and everything will be fine. Charles Dickens, England, is the natural state of an economy without government interference. And that's what these guys say they want, right? Rand Paul, we shouldn't have any government interference in the marketplace. Well, if you have no government interference in the marketplace, you are going to have no middle class whatsoever. You are going to have a very small class of very wealthy people at the top. You're going to have a very small class of middle-class people who are professionals, the doctor, the lawyer, the butcher, the baker, the candlestick maker, the shop owners. And you're going to have a very large class of the working poor. Charles Dickens, England.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Just listen to their rhetoric. This is what they're calling for. This is why they don't want to extend unemployment benefits. God forbid, people might have a little money in their pockets. Welcome back. Well, let's get some calls in here, too. We've got a lot of stuff we've talked about today, and you know, we can pretty much cover anything you want. Law in Jamaica, New York, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. Thanks for calling. What's up?
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
I'm well. How are you?
Tom, always room for improvement, biggest room in the house. Listen,
thanks.
Tom, I wanted to reach out to you today and plug a gentleman by the name of Maloney. He has a series called The Hidden Secrets of Money. And in The Hidden Secrets of Money, he kind of explains to us or breaks it down to us how what we think is money works. And I think it's vitally important for the viewers here and people abroad to kind of familiarize themselves with what we believe or think is money and what actually is money. What I've learned in the short time from having watched this series is that the only real money is gold and silver.
No, that's not true.
And
respectfully,
we have that.
Respectfully, Law, it's not true. You know, if in the middle of a famine, a bucket of wheat will have much more value than any amount of gold or silver. Money is what people are willing to exchange basically the necessities of life for.
Okay, and we're in agreement, Tom. I'm in agreement with you. You're always the sharp guy, and you kind of beat me to the punch there as far as commodities and basically money being an exchange.
Yeah, it's just a medium of exchange for commodities or for services, for goods or services.
There we go.
Yeah.
There we go. But one of the reasons that I think it's vitally important that people familiarize themselves with this is so that we become aware of what's transpired through the years, how the U.S. dollar has lost, I think it's 97, almost 98% of the wealth that it once had. And I think a good analysis of that, my mother, who's now 90 years of age, tell stories of going to the movies as probably maybe being 10 or 12 years old, where she would take a quarter and she could get into the movies for a nickel, and a nickel got her a soda, and a nickel got her a candy bar, and a nickel got her a bag of popcorn. And when she went into the movie, it was 12 o'clock, and by the time she came out, she saw two feature films and several cartoons in between, and that quarter, she still had a nickel left of it.
Yeah, but see, that on the flip side of that is that 20 cents that she spent for all that afternoon entertainment. If you went today to two feature films and bought popcorn and Coke and everything, you'd spend about $30, and that's about 4 hours work at minimum wage. And back when your mother was going to the movie theater, the prevailing wage was 5 cents an hour. So, you know, it's the you can say that the value of our money has changed, and it has. I mean, we do that continuously and intentionally by a process called inflation. And it helps governments, and inflation actually helps debtors. It helps people pay off debt with money that has less value over time. So money always inures a benefit both to government, because government's always in debt, and to people who have large amounts of debt, like mortgages and things. It's still the rate of exchange between what you get for your labor and what you pay for your goods and services really hasn't changed that much. And that's what's the important thing. It's not that, you know, what used to cost 20 cents now costs $20. That's a startling statistic. You're right. But that's not the thing of consequence. Well, we'll have to continue this conversation another time. Thanks a lot for the call. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Harvey in Berkeley, California. Hey, Harvey, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. Well, I'd like to see the unions go in and organize both the guards and the prisoners in the prisons for profit, because they're a business, and in fact, they're listed on the stock exchange.
Right.
And I feel that, you know, and you were talking earlier about the woman, Michelle Leonhard, the head of the DNA. DEA. She was really mad about the legalization of marijuana. I think she was a Bush appointee. I think I heard you say that.
Yeah.
And, well, of course she's mad because the marijuana people who got busted for marijuana were the perfect resource for the prisons for profit. They were cheap labor. They were nonviolent. They didn't. Prisons for profit don't want violent types. And so by legalizing it all, they've sort of they've killed a major resource for the prisons for profit. And,
well, and not just the prisons for profit. The DEA itself is a little empire, and a large part of that empire is committed to pot. And so basically by decriminalizing pot, what we're doing is we're saying to Michelle Leonhardt, sorry, you know, you're going to have to reduce your staff or reduce your budget and thus reduce your power and your prestige by a certain amount. And, you know, which I think we should be doing. Actually, I think we should be reallocating it. I think that, you know, we should be, you know, dealing with drugs as a medical problem rather than a criminal problem. And I think the DEA could reinvent itself even, you know, as a medical service. But I doubt she's inclined to do that. She's all, you know, she's running an agency that's all about guns and battering rams and tanks and things.
And about prisons, back to the prisons for profit. I mean, that's a slap in the face to the American worker. It costs money to go to work every day. And here you get the government giving, I don't know, $60 to $80 to the prisons for profit to maintain the prisoners, feed them, clothe them, and anything they make over that is profit. So I feel that you know, this is America's answer to third world labor, and I'd like to see the unions once again go in and level the playing field, organize both the guards and the prisoners.
So would I. If we want to do that, we need to roll back Taft-Hartley, and we need to make some serious changes in all the holes that have been drilled into the National Labor Relations Act, the Wagner Act, since 1935. Actually, the holes have been drilled there since 1946. And there was 47, starting with the Republican legislature that was elected in 46 during Truman's era. And we've got a long way to go. I mean, we're down to 7% unionization in the private sector. You know, when most of your European countries are 70, 80, 90%, we have so far to go. But Harvey, you nailed it. Thanks a lot for the call. Richard in Spokane. Hey, Richard, what's up?
Hey. Are you on now?
We are live and on the air, you and me, both of us. Yep.
All right. I'm looking at you, but I don't see you talking.
Well, there's about a 30 or 40 second delay on the TV side. On the radio side, it's about an 10 second delay.
It
takes a while for all those electrons to bounce off satellites and things.
Yeah. What I'm wanting to do is just stress the importance of campaign finance reform. We need to do it, and we need to do it like worse than anything else that we need to do.
But the problem is we can't do it until the Supreme Court until we get around the Supreme Court, because the Supreme Court has said that money is protected under the First Amendment via the word speech, free speech, that money is the same thing as free speech, and therefore it's constitutionally protected. And it shouldn't be. And so we have to pass a constitutional amendment, and this is why MoveToAmend.org is such an important organization. We need to pass a constitutional amendment that says money is not speech, and it needs to be done just as quickly as possible, because then we can have that campaign reform that you were talking about. Pardon my...
Yeah. You know, the connection that I wanted to make, I mean, we know that that's important. That is very important. But even, I mean, relative to all of our problems anymore, even Putin, or whatever his name is, over in,
Putin.
In
yeah.
Russia, all he's doing is blueprinting us.
Well, to some extent. I mean, he's at least willing to put his oligarchs in jail. We dance to the tune of ours, so... the shock therapy that the former Soviet Union went through, that Russia went through, has left them with a fairly badly distorted economy. Richard, thank you for the call. Nicholas in Las Vegas. Hey, Richard, or Nicholas, what's up?
Well, thanks. First of all, you know, just a few days ago, I was still living in Romania, where for a few years I've finished a book, Under the Juggernaut of History and Religion. You are in it, Tom.
Hmm.
And I was listening to you on RT. I was an Air Force pilot in Romania. I escaped in 81. I lived in Alaska and a few other states. I did quite well in various businesses. I'm an activist. In 1999, I ordered the first Prius in the Northwest, Pacific Northwest. Did a number of NGOs.
And your point is?
Cohen had brought you a dose of realism about Russia, and when he explained Crimea is Russian land,
mm-hmm.
didn't do anything else but to really bring us to realism, just like Kissinger a little while ago mentioned on Farid Zakaria, the problem in the Middle East, in Syria primarily, is a religious one, not geopolitics. What I want to bring to you is that now living in Romania for the last few years mostly, I've come to understand that the collusion of interest between the state and the church is so deep, and that is exactly what is happening in Russia.
Hmm.
On the opposite...
The Russian Orthodox Church?
Russian, Romanian, pretty much, you know,
yeah.
the same
yeah.
formula.
Yeah, the Eastern Orthodox Church.
Collusion
yeah.
of interest, you know, that they would not let democracy gain a foothold. It
right.
is imperative, you know, that we bring the separation, talking about the Professor K yesterday,
right.
Thomas Paine. Now, let me ask you a question. If we are to look at the most advanced democracies and places where society and civilization truly does prosper, aren't they the Nordic countries where
yes.
both Reformation and application? Okay, now I want to ask you now, a couple of years ago, an Ipsos poll showed that in Nordic countries, some 80% of the people are declared non-religious.
That's correct.
In Canada, 66% of the entire of the poll people.
Nicholas, I think I know where you're going, but we're going to have to continue the conversation another time. I'm sorry, we're out of time. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
If your argument was those countries that are less religious are more prosperous and have a higher quality of life, yes, it seems to be the case. It's the good, the bad, and the very, very kerosenely ugly. Brought to you by the organic wine company, EcoWine.com. The good. Senator Harry Reid. While speaking on the Senate floor yesterday, the Senate Majority Leader blasted Republicans for their close connection to the billionaire Koch brothers, saying that the GOP lawmakers might as well wear Koch insignia patches on their suits. Check it out.
NASCAR fans can easily find their favorite drivers by simply looking at the cars as they fly by, because there are corporate emblems on the hood of the car. In fact, they're all over the car. Though our clothing here in the Senate, we don't bear any commercial logos. Many Republican senators these days might as well wear Koch Industries insignias.
Harry Reid's right. Our elected representatives have become little more than tools of corporate elite. Koch insignia is a great idea, but I think we should go a little farther. As I argued in my book, Rebooting the American Dream, all lawmakers, whether they're Democrat or Republican or anywhere in between, should have to wear NASCAR patches showing the names of their donors. That way everyone can see who Congress is really working for. The bad. Aaron Miller. Every person who's ever run for political office has one moment that inspires them to take a stand and start campaigning. For Aaron Miller, who's running for Congress in Minnesota, it was apparently the moment he heard that his daughter was learning about evolution in school. He recently told the Mankato Free Press that, quote, his daughter told the teacher that she did not believe in evolution, and that the teacher expressed agreement with his daughter, but told her that they were forced to teach the lesson by the government. According to Aaron Miller, the people should decide what they learn, not those evil, pointy-headed commies in Washington, D.C., I hate to break it to Mr. Miller, but evolution is a fact. And if you think it's tyrannical for the government to require students to learn facts, then I don't think you really have any business running for Congress. And the very, very ugly, Breitbart.com. The conservative website is under fire today for its outrageously offensive ad campaign for its new California politics-focused vertical. The most controversial of the ads shows House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi twerking like Miley Cyrus around a muscular caricature of California Governor Jerry Brown. The DNC has called the ad foul, offensive, and disrespectful to all women, and I have to say I agree. By the way, the artist behind the Pelosi ad, Sabo, is a self-described, quote, Republican in Hollywood who has, in the past, complained about Jews on his Facebook page and painted a picture of Hillary Clinton titled, Hillary, the B-word is back. What a guy. That's just very weird. That's mind-bogglingly ugly. Okay. So, Arthur, in Homewood, Illinois, listening to WCPT. Hey, Arthur, what's up?
Good afternoon, sir. The only thing I want to say is about the Reagan. Now, I'm a meat cutter. Been a meat cutter all my life.
Mm-hmm.
I became manager for Jewel. I wanted to get up. I wanted to make more money. Now, what is wrong with having money? What is wrong with the rich people? What's wrong with the Koch brothers? When I was, they asked me if I wanted to take a 401k profit share. I said, I sure do. Half of my friends, butchers, did not. But we had the opportunity, okay? I was making more money when Reagan was in office on my 401k than I was on my salary. So what are you beating up these rich people for if they're going to make money for the workers? Now, the only reason we're out of work is they won't open the coal mines. They won't open up the...
We're mining more coal than we ever have in the history of the United States.
Yeah, rock 'em, we're not working them. And you know, I don't understand this.
We're not. We're taking mountaintops off instead of putting miners down in mines.
People still work for Democrats, vote for the Democrats, and they're killing the jobs. Why they're killing the jobs? Oh,
Arthur, the Democratic Arthur, you have no interest in listening, do you? I'm not even going to get into it. Charles in Opa-locka, Florida. Hey, Charles, what's on your mind?
I'm fine. How you doing, Tom?
Good.
I'm calling in because my biggest concern isn't, of course, Obamacare. That's already the land of the lost. It's taking effect, and I think that the conservatives, after all of these years, have taken over the airwaves with all this gloom and doom, all this all of this. I guess, how you call it, when they're predicting the future and it's all wrong.
Right.
Basically, what I'm asking for now is that we focus our attention on jobs. You mentioned before that, the media is basically on the Republican side. Well, I want to know, is there any way that we can have our own media? I mean...
Oh, you're listening to it right now. There is a fairly vibrant progressive media in the United States. It exists largely on the internet, on some radio stations, on some TV networks, on free speech TV, on cable. You find little fragments of it on commercial television. Fairly well heeled and well tamed, but they're there. But the fact of the matter is that the media in the United States, since Reagan stopped enforcing the Sherman Act in 82, the media has gone from being owned by thousands and thousands and thousands of families and small businesses all over the country to being basically owned by, fewer than a dozen companies. And their interests are aligned with the interests of the Republican Party. So the media is always going to have a Republican bias. And so, we need our own narrative instead of listening to the Republican talking points. You're absolutely right. And we have to be the voice of that. And whether it's in the internet or whether it's, movement politics or whether it's getting inside the Democratic Party and participating, whatever it may be, we need to be doing it. Charles, thank you for the call. Excellent point. Michael in Boulder Creek, California. Hey, Michael, what's up?
Hi, Tom. First time, long time.
Thank you.
I want to know what your opinion is with Maryland. They're decriminalizing,
right.
And Alaska is going to have full legalization probably by the end of the year.
Yep.
Most of the politicians are trying to get on the right side of this issue. Do you think that if Obama created some sort of allowance for medical cannabis under Obamacare, so make it mandatory in every state? Under Obamacare, it would really remove it as an issue in this election cycle. I'll take my answer off on the air.
That's an interesting question. Well, thank you, Michael, for the call. I don't. The Obamacare standards are, I believe, congressionally established. I might be wrong on that, though. It might be that Congress says that there are standards and then the administration has to come up with the standards. I don't know how much latitude he has in establishing those standards. A. B, as long as pot is scheduled as a Schedule I drug, you know, no medical value whatsoever, then, you know, it wouldn't be possible to include it in Obamacare. Now, I've heard conflicting stories on this. I've heard from some experts that the administration, therefore the president, has the power to simply reschedule marijuana and say, you know, we're going to turn this from Schedule I to Schedule III, you know, and put it in the category with, you know, psychoactive prescription drugs like Valium. Or even more strong, you know, Schedule II, put it in there with morphine. But I've also heard people say that it's going to take legislation to do that because the original anti-marijuana laws were passed legislatively. So I'm not quite sure what the truth is on that. I keep getting slightly different stories. But the president could lead on it, and I think the day will come when he does. You'll recall he was opposed to gay marriage, and then one day he was suddenly for gay marriage, and then there was just this landslide. I believe that if he does something very similar to that with medical marijuana, that'd be easy, or even recreational marijuana, which would be much more difficult for him because the whole country's not there yet. Right? In the South, it's going to not work well. But who knows? But I think that if he were to make that shift and make it very publicly, particularly in advance of the 2014 elections, and let Republicans campaign on throwing people in jail for pot, I think that you could see a real sea change in the politics of this country. Emmanuel in Chicago. Hey, Emmanuel.
Hey, how you doing, Tom Hartman? You talked about economics earlier.
Yeah.
And I really wanted to address an idea that I learned. First of all, I called you once before. And I talked about intellectuals and how it wasn't meant to be a slam. I said that out of frustration of how, take it as an example, the way the president tried to use a metaphor to describe during this campaign to describe how the economy was going, like somebody drove it off a cliff.
Right.
So that's a metaphor, but guys like Arthur, who just called just a little while ago, metaphors isn't that descriptive. Some kind of way, give you an example of what I'm talking about, some kind of way the progressives and liberals need to be able to explain to people like Arthur how economics work.
Yeah, I started to do that, but Arthur had no interest in hearing it. He had a series of bumper stickers that he wanted to get on the air. And, you know, which is fine. We've all heard these bumper stickers. But, you know, so I cut him off. If he had wanted to engage me in a conversation, I would have loved to have had that conversation. I could have explained to him, you know, how 401ks got invented basically during the Reagan era and why. And why, you know, he did well in his 401k. Wonderful. You know, the stock market went up dramatically during the Reagan era. Why? Because Reagan was not following Reaganomics. Reagan was following Keynesian economics. He was doing it mostly through Star Wars. He borrowed $3 trillion and spent it. Emmanuel, thanks for the call. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I mean, it's so funny. When Republicans are in office, they don't practice Republican economics. They practice Keynesian economics. When Democrats are in office, Republicans force them to be Republican. And welcome back. David in Anderson, South Carolina. Hey, David, what's on your mind today?
Well, wow, you guys are covering so much today. Arthur, though, says he got brought up, incidentally. I'm afraid he represents way too many people out there. They unfortunately have an anecdotal viewpoint of the world that this worked for me, so why didn't it work for everybody else?
Well, and also somehow he thinks that, you know, his net worth, which I'm guessing is well under $1 million, and his income, which I'm guessing is probably well under $100,000, qualifies him to empathize with, or not qualifies is the wrong word, means that he should empathize with and vote the interests of the Koch brothers and the multibillionaires. And, you know, he doesn't get how he's being played.
Yeah, that's what kind of throws me. Again, here, I mean, you know how we vote down here. I voted for Obama and did my late wife. And there's these people, and there are people around here who, frankly, aren't that crazy about the Republicans, but they get played one way or the other. Of course, down here, a lot of times the Republicans play the religion card, and people are like, well, I don't really care for Republicans, but they vote for this. But but a lot of these people like Arthur, because their situation is, even maybe the ones that aren't so boneheaded, I hate to throw names around, like he was behaving, they have an attitude. This, I don't know, they're like, sorry, I'm trying to get my train of thought here. This worked for me, my family, I have people that retired, they did fine, and then they're bad about it gets real easy to get on that train of get a job. I've worked hard my whole life. Right now, I belong to 10 temp agencies. I've been out of work for 4 weeks. Oh. And by golly, I'm going to tell you something. I'd like to have a job because it's a whole lot harder trying to find one than it is to keep one once you have it.
Yep.
But these guys, if it doesn't happen to them or their kids or somebody in their family or their neighbor, they seem insulated.
Well, and Arthur was fortunate enough to be in the workforce and have fully come of age in an economy that was created by Franklin Roosevelt and Dwight Eisenhower and, you know, by liberals, basically. And, you know, Reagan only began taking apart the American economy in the 1980s. The decade of the 80s, there were a few hiccups during that period of time, but you know, it's an exponential curve. You know, it's the damage of the 80s, you know, kind of seeped into the 90s and even into the early 2000s. And then it started really, really getting bad when George W. Bush started doubling and tripling down on Reaganomics. And now it's just, you know, it's out of control. And I mean, you just saw a 13% increase in the income of CEOs nationwide to $10.3 million on average per year.
Around here, their average so-called well-paying job is $8 an hour, which doesn't cover utilities. I've had to work two jobs on and off about the last 4 or 5 years.
Yeah, I'm sorry to hear that. But and David, increasingly you represent the norm in America. We are moving from a country, you know, 30 years ago, when Reagan came into office, the biggest employer in America was General Motors. And if you'd worked at General Motors for 5 years, you made, in inflation-adjusted dollars, $50 an hour in today's money. Now the largest employer in the country is Walmart. Hey, let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service and find out what's going on in the world. It's brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com. You can give the gift of a goat to a returning slave in South Sudan. Bob Ney on the line with us, former congressman and author of Sideswipe, The Insider's Guide to Washington, D.C. Hey, Bob.
Hello, Tom. How are you?
I am great, but I'll get better. I hope the same is true of you.
I'm doing pretty good with the weather.
Okay, so what's going on in the world?
Well, sort of a almost okay corral shootout had there been guns. The Attorney General, Eric Holder, went to House Judiciary, and it was on the, you know, an issue where he was testifying. And the next thing you know, Representative Louie Gohmert of Texas began pressing him on another issue, which pressing him for documents and the issue referring to the 2012 House vote where they found the Attorney General in contempt of Congress, the Republican side did. And all of a sudden, Gohmert pulls this out, which is a separate issue. You know, that's not what the Attorney General was there for. And Gohmert, the congressman, Republican, said, "I realize that contempt is not a big deal," quoting him, "to our Attorney General, but it's important that we have proper oversight." And then the Attorney General Holder sat back in a chair and said, "You don't want to go there, buddy." Yeah. Leaned back his chair again and said, "You don't want to go there, okay?" And then, of course, Gohmert responded back, "I don't want to go there." And It was very entertaining, I would say, today in Washington.
Yeah, yeah. In fact, I think I have the audio of it. It's I can just play a little piece of it here. It's pretty hysterical.
"I promise, and it is inadequate, and I realize that contempt is not a big deal to our Attorney General, but it is important that we have proper oversight."
"You don't want to go there, buddy.
So
you don't want to go there, okay?"
"I don't want to go there?"
"No.
About the contempt?"
"You should not assume that that is not a big deal to me.
I think that it was inappropriate. I think it was unjust. But never think that that was not a big deal to me.
Yeah. Quit telling me what I think.
Yeah, you got to kind of like the Attorney General. You know, everybody's all with a distinguished gentleman yield, and all of a sudden he says, hey, don't go there, buddy.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I thought it was pretty real.
Yeah.
You know, Tom, it was I would call this a sort of economic day on Capitol Hill, and it's there for a reason. And the president did two executive orders, of course, one all with dealing with federal contractors, one gathering data under the Labor Department of, you know, gender, amount of money made, et cetera, to find out about this wage disparity, you know, with female.
Right, because the day today is the day on which the women of America have made as much money as the men of America did on December 31st of last year.
That's right. This is the day, and so the president did that executive order, and he did another one that says, look, you can discuss your salaries and not be penalized by a federal contractor. This dovetails into the equity pay bill that's going to be going through the United States Senate, which, you know, obviously some of the Republicans are going to have trouble with that. But it also, when I say economic day, in a different topic, but the unemployment extension, which went through the Senate, and then Speaker Boehner came up and said, well, it's unwarranted, unnecessary, et cetera. He doesn't like the bill, and he wants to add Keystone Pipeline, you know, other items in there. But, excuse me, Frank Lobiondo, who's a Republican House member from New Jersey, who is no wallflower by any stretch of imagination, and a few other Republicans are starting to bubble up saying, wait a minute, you know, people are hurting. So you're going to see a further battle in the House. I don't think it's going to be so easy. The Speaker just doesn't call a vote.
Interesting.
On that unemployment
bill. How much time do you give him before he cracks?
Well, on this one,
mm-hmm.
I would.
On unemployment.
I'll give him about 30 days on this one.
That's a long time.
Lobiondo will.
I mean, there's people losing their homes. You got 2 million people who got cut off back the, you know, 3 days after Christmas. That was months ago. And they've had to pay.
Lobiondo will ask simply for a vote.
Yeah.
You know, let the Democrats and Republicans do their will.
Yeah. Well, if he's a Republican member of Congress, of the House, if he can get, what is it, 17 or 19 of his colleagues to go along with the Democrats, they can force a discharge petition.
Well, that's correct. They can get to the 217 signatures, and then it has to automatically have a vote.
Right. Interesting.
And I think that the reason, you know, this is all coming up to the economics is because it strikes a nerve. It's going to be very delicate for the, especially the Senate, which is, you know, flip a coin here and there on the races. It's going to be very delicate to see how they handle it, not only public policy, but the politics of it.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. What else is up?
Well, the other thing, the Cuban Twitter thing is amazing. Once again, they have developed USAID, developed his Twitter account, and Senator Leahy, a Democratic chair of the subcommittee on appropriations, the money committee, said, one, why didn't you tell us? And two, who did this dumb idea? Mm-hmm. But they went through an offshore company and then in the Caribbean, and then they also went through Spain, got CEOs to be involved in this that didn't know what was going on, created a Twitter account, and it was all aimed to try to bring Castro down, to have a revolution.
Right.
And so it's not going to.
It was about as bright as the exploding cigar idea.
Oh, and you know, Bush administration was cooperating with people that were against the Iranian regime, and they were a bunch of, you know, people that no one knew where on earth they came from. So every once in a while, one of these, you know, pops up, and there you see it.
Yeah.
And also, the Supreme Court declined a free speech quote/slash gay marriage case, and that was a New Mexico case, and the Supreme Court declined to consider that case and involved the Christian business owners who refused to photograph a same-sex ceremony. So it goes back to the ruling in Albuquerque, which says that that was discrimination.
Right, although it only stands for the state of New Mexico. It doesn't apply anywhere else in the country.
Yeah. But, you know, that whole thing was spurned, as you know, with the piece of legislation out in Arizona, and then it started to get some traction in other states like Ohio, and it's kind of went away after Arizona did its mess out there.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how that all plays out. We were talking earlier about medical marijuana and how, you know, Maryland's about to decriminalize it. D.C. did last week, although it's got to be approved by Congress. Do you think there's any possibility that this administration will ever make a shift on pot the way they did on gay marriage?
I don't think. I really don't think they will.
I think so.
I think they'll just write it out as their...
I think that could be such a game changer for the Democrats, but, you know...
I don't think they will.
Yeah, okay. But you know D.C. a lot better than me. Bob Ney, the Talk Radio News Service, the author of Sideswiped. Thank you, Bob.
Thank you.
Great talking with you. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com, America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com, Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show. So please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and... Boy, you know, the traditional conservatives and Reaganism and all this kind of stuff, they were trying to reverse FDR and LBJ, right? The New Deal and the Great Society. But the libertarians, they want to reverse Teddy Roosevelt, who was, you know, a progressive but not a socialist. I mean, he's just, you know, he thought the square. He actually, Teddy Roosevelt thought that regulating business was necessary in order to preserve it. He created our national park system, the Antiquities Act, in 1906. He prosecuted trusts under the Sherman Antitrust Act, initiated the breakup of Standard Oil, which Taft finished. He established the Food and Drug Administration. Remember Upton Sinclair and the jungle? It's just, I don't get it. Adrian Moore is with us, Ph.D., Vice President of Policy for the Reason Foundation, the libertarian think tank. He's the co-author of Mobility First, A New Vision for Transportation in a Globally Competitive 21st Century. Adrian, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Tom. Glad to be on.
Why do you guys want to roll back Teddy Roosevelt? What's this, let's pass a law that says that the president can't create any more national parks nonsense?
Well, last time I looked, there were no libertarians in Congress, so I don't know why you're accusing me.
Well, you'd prefer to be called a Republican?
No.
Okay.
I am not trying to roll back anything of Teddy Roosevelt's. There are some folks in Congress that are upset about some of the activities of the administration on declaring new parks. And, I think there's these things, when they become political, there's always a certain amount of nonsense. And there is definitely a certain amount of nonsense.
But this is not political.
Their basic point is, Tom, that 32% of the square acreage of the United States right now is protected by federal, state,
and about 28% of the square acreage of the United States is absolutely uninhabitable.
Right. Well, don't you want your wilderness to be uninhabitable? That's kind of the point.
Well, that's what's happened is, and an awful lot of those national parks were lands that, you know, during a couple of different depressions, but, you know, basically since Teddy Roosevelt's time, you know, people tried to settle them and they couldn't, and so the federal government took it back. People weren't paying their taxes and things. But what does the percentage of it have to do with anything? It's not like we're trying to declare Detroit a national park.
No, I think the point is how much of the United States needs to be declared a national park and be not developable, not usable in any way other than for recreation under government control. I think a third is probably a pretty reasonable amount. And even if the Republicans in Congress get their way and they slightly restrict, this is, you know, I saw a bunch of articles saying this bans future national parks. It clearly doesn't. It says you can only do so many new national parks per year in the future. So it limits the future growth of national parks.
Yeah. What was the, please refresh my memory here, Adrian. What was the horrible national park that President Obama wanted to create that's got
the dander up here? Nonsense I was talking about. I don't know. It was not even like, it's not what I think most of us think of when we think of national parks. You know, we think of, you know, the Grand Canyon and Yellowstone and things like that. This was some very small, really.
I think it was Big Bear Dunes in Michigan, wasn't it?
I thought it was in California.
Oh, okay. Maybe it is. My wife and I were talking about Big Bear Dunes. She used to go there as a little kid. But in any case, wherever it is, I mean, you know, what does it matter? Why is it that Republicans are just reflexively this knee jerk? Anything the president tries to do, they're going to try and take him down for.
Yeah, you know, I agree. I think both parties do. It's part of the political.
It's not something both parties do. Adrian, when Reagan was president, when George Bush was president, the Democrats went along with the vast majority of the stuff that these guys did. And in fact, when Jerry Ford was president and when Bush Sr. was president, Democrats went along with an enormous amount of stuff that those guys
did. They also introduced an enormous number of bills to spit in the eye of the administration. That's what political parties do.
For example,
Tom, seriously, you're going to say we can disagree ideologically, but if you don't agree that politicians tend to be kind of petty people, then I don't even know what we're talking about.
No, what I'm saying is that the Republican Party plays scorched earth politics. That a group of Republicans got together the night that Barack Obama was inaugurated in January 2009. And basically swore a blood oath to each other. And I've had Newt Gingrich on this program. He was in the meeting, and he's talked about it. And basically swore a blood oath to each other that they would obstruct everything he did, even if it was good for the country, period, because they wanted him to have a failed presidency so that history would look back on it the way that they've reinvented the history of Jimmy Carter.
They didn't have control of any of it. They didn't have control of either chamber of Congress, and they were politically desperate. And that's exactly what I'm talking about.
They had the ability to filibuster legislation in the Senate, and they used it regularly. And it was only 11 months there until after Ted Kennedy died, until Scott Brown was installed, when Obama had a filibuster-proof Congress. And he got a hell of a lot of stuff done during that 11 months, including Obamacare. But, you know, ever since then, it's been back to the and Pete Sessions. I mean, you know, he said, we're going to be like the Taliban. This was his quote. We're the Taliban. I mean, I've never heard of Democrats acting like this. I've never seen a presidency where the Democratic Party blocked everything. I mean, look at the number of filibusters.
I disagree. And if I'd known we were going to talk about this, I would dug up something else.
You should look up the facts, Adrian.
20 years, Tom, I have. I've been watching politics for 20 years, and it's my observation that both parties are equally venal when they get in this opposition mode. It's the nature of politics. It has nothing to do with the parties. And whichever party is not in power tends to be the worst. The Republicans are really being bad about it now. You go back to the 80s, and the Democrats had periods when they were really bad about it. It's the nature of politics.
You had Democrats going along with Reagan on all kinds of stuff.
Republicans, sure they did. And
there's no Republicans going along with Obama. Not one. I mean, even extending unemployment insurance. Extending unemployment insurance, for God's sake. There's 2 million people who are losing their homes. Their families are falling apart. They can't pay the coldest winter in history, and they can't pay for heat. And John Boehner says we won't do it unless you make enrich the Koch brothers by another $40 billion by extending the Keystone XL pipeline. Seriously?
Oh.
I mean, that's what he just said.
Well, first of all, there are a lot of good reasons not to extend unemployment insurance. It's not unemployment insurance anymore. It's just another welfare benefit.
These people have been paying into it their whole lives.
We did welfare reform by realizing that you have to have some endpoint. you have to have some incentive to get off the dole. And
FDR told us what it was: make the government the employer of last resort, and when capitalism starts functioning again, dial it back.
Yeah, because we all know. Name to me all of the dial backs that the federal government has done in the last 10 years. The federal government doesn't.
There's no more WPA. There's no more CCC. There's no more RTC. There's
much bigger and more expansive programs. They didn't get rid of
Star Wars.
Well, that was just a line item. I'm talking about.
That was $1 trillion.
Initiative.
Star Wars.
If you think once the government is providing millions of jobs, that they are then going to stop providing those jobs when you don't even agree that they should stop providing unemployment insurance at some point.
No, I think that a job would be better than unemployment insurance. I agree with FDR that the best welfare program is a job. And
I'm not sure that make work jobs are the best. I agree that a job is the best, but make work jobs don't necessarily improve people's skill or willingness to get real jobs.
They give them a paycheck. Anyhow, Adrian Moore, reason.org is the website. Thanks, Adrian.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
In fact, thank you for dropping by. I didn't properly thank you. Thank you.
No problem. Thanks.
Good talk. We'll be back. And welcome back. Let's see here. Corky in Hilton, New York. Hey, Corky, you wanted to talk about 401ks?
I'm loving your show today.
Thank you.
Talking about the 401ks.
Yeah.
That's an organized theft ring.
Of course.
What happens is you put your money in a 401k and they buy mutual funds.
Yeah.
Within those mutual funds are certain stocks that don't do very well. So while you're at work, they're crashing those stocks, those individual stocks, in your portfolio. The wealthy people, they're sitting at their computer trading the stock. They don't lose a dime.
Yeah.
You come home from work and your mutual fund has just lost $40 a share.
Yeah. No, they're skimming and scamming and sliding
and
off the top.
They steal from you there, and then they turn around and make you subsidize Walmart workers.
Yep.
Incomes.
Yep.
It's organized stuff. We've got to start getting wild and mad.
Mm-hmm. I think a lot of us are. I think a lot of us are. And I think that, you know, as every day that goes by that John Boehner says, oh, we're up to 2.3 million people who don't have long-term unemployment insurance. Screw them. I think that, you know, and next week it's going to be 2.4 million people. And the week after that, it'll be 2.6 million people. And as Boehner keeps saying that, and Eric Cantor and Paul Ryan and all these other Republican luminaries, as they continue, you know, with these positions, I have a feeling that the election of 2014 is not going to go the way that the Republicans think it's going to go. But we'll see. We'll see. Anyhow, Corky, thanks for the call. Rick in Las Vegas. Hey, Rick, what's up? Rick?
Hello.
Hey, you have a solution for our do-nothing Congress?
Yeah, it's kind of a comic relief. What if we offered the House of Representatives and the senators minimum wage? And see how they would deal with the country.
Well, that's interesting.
Perspective.
Yeah, and just fix, you know, whatever the minimum wage is, that's congressional pay.
Yeah, and let them see what it's like to live on $7.25 an hour.
Yeah, I have a feeling they'd raise the minimum wage really quick.
Anyways, I just thought you were having such a serious day, I had to give you a little.
Yeah, well, it's a good, you know, it's actually, that's a variation on the proposal that the Republicans put forward, that every member of Congress would have to go on Obamacare. And in fact, they did it. I mean, you know, the congressional staffs now have to go on Obamacare. And, you know, they're getting some pretty good deals, but, you know, it's not as good as what they had before. And I think maybe this is causing them to think maybe we should improve Obamacare somewhat. Who knows?
I agree with you.
Yeah. So step by step. Anyhow, Rick, thanks a lot for the call. That's a good one. That is a good one. Minimum wage for members of Congress. You know, you really do. I mean, members of Congress, I think they make around $180,000 a year, which in this country is a hell of a lot of money. I mean, that's a mind-boggling amount of money. On the other hand, they've got to maintain a home here and a home someplace else, or at least a residence here. And they've got to travel back and forth, although I think that travel gets paid for. But I don't know. I'm ambivalent about it. I think that if we want to have a good Congress that actually does the work of government, that you don't want them grubbing money on the side to be able to get by. It makes them more vulnerable to corruption. And on the other hand, you know, I don't think anybody should get rich as a member of Congress, but frankly, I don't think anybody is. We'll be back. 20 minutes, best. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Jim in Camino, Washington, or Island, Washington, you wanted to disagree about wall warts?
Yeah. Tom, those our devices work on about a 5-volt level there, all those little magic bits of sand and everything. So they're really sort of operating as though they're on battery.
The formula is W equals EI, wattage equals voltage times amperage. So if you have 110 volts in at, say, 1/10 of a watt, you're consuming roughly 1/10 of an amp, you're consuming roughly 10 watts of electricity. So if you put that out at 5 volts and you want it to be 10 watts, you need 2 amps. Right. So all these things are doing is they're changing the level of voltage and current.
Exactly. And you really don't want 110 volts going into things that are getting anywhere near your body. And so if you want to arrange things so that 5 volts comes out of the wall somehow, that's one thing. But you don't want to burden the devices by inserting that voltage changing equipment inside the these little phones and readers.
So the assertion that you're making is that wall warts, these little transformers that plug into the walls, here's my problem with them, to revisit this because a lot of people don't know what the hell we're talking about. We had this conversation a couple of days ago that something like 10% of the electricity in the United States is consumed by transformers that are plugged into the wall that are continuously transforming electricity that is not being used. When you're actually sucking voltage down off them, they might be pulling 10 watts, but when you're not, they're still pulling 1 or 2 watts because they're just kind of sitting there in idling mode.
And that's because they're stupid.
Whereas it is, you're right. And
they shouldn't be consuming any power at all when there's no load on them.
I agree.
And that's just a matter of designing the things properly.
Well, it could be. It would be a little more expensive. But this all has to do with, I think it's UAL. No, it's
UL?
Underwriters Laboratory.
Yeah.
It might be Underwriters Laboratory. There's an agency that certifies electronic equipment as basically worthy of being legally sold in the United States.
Right.
And when they changed the rules 15 years ago or so and said that, they started dropping the wattage. It used to be, if a device consumed less than 30 watts, it didn't have to be regulated. And then they dropped it down to 20 watts. And then, as things got transistorized and then IC miniaturized and things like that. And then they said if the power supply is not inside the device, it doesn't need to be certified. So only the power supply needs to be certified. So now
some of it might have to do with voltage levels more than.
That was the rationale. I mean, as an electrical engineer, I can build a case for this. You've got a device that's running off 5 volts, and you're right. If you drop that thing in the bathtub with you, it's not going to electrocute you. 5 volts isn't going to penetrate your skin. The fact of the matter is most of us don't have electrical appliances sitting next to our bathtubs, but that nonetheless. But the unintended consequence of that was that everybody moved to wall warts so that they wouldn't have to go through the certification process for, 15 different varieties of their clock radio or whatever. And they could only just certify 1 or 2 wall warts, right? And buy generic ones and relabel them. And now we've got all these wall warts all over the place, and we're pretty much the only country in the world that does. And if you're making the argument that we're safer because of this, I would say, A, burning off 10% of our electricity and throwing hundreds of thousands, maybe hundreds of millions of tons of carbon into the atmosphere is not making us safer. In fact, people are dying because of this, you know, mile-wide hurricanes and superstorm standing and stuff like that. And B, I really don't think that we were having a huge problem with people being electrocuted by electronic devices. When 110 used to go into the clock radio, and when you turned it on, what you were doing was you were turning on and off the 110 to the little transformer that was mounted inside the radio, rather than now turning on the 5 volts or 7.5 or 9 or 12 volts or whatever it is that's going into it.
Well, the clock radio there was, like maybe half a cubic foot in size, too, and the extra electronics involved in the voltage transformation wasn't that big a burden on the device. But
it doesn't need to be now. I mean, a lot of these wall warts are unnecessarily large, simply because they're running continuously and because they're designed to be available for, you know, you've got a 10-watt wall wart, right? So you've got devices, for example, you know, 5 volts at 2 amps. 2 amps is a hell of a lot of juice. The little Apple chargers for your, you know, 5 volts is the standard for USB. The little Apple chargers are one amp. The high-speed chargers are 2 amps. So it's 5 watts or 10 watts at 5 volts. So it's not a lot of current. So what they do is they'll make a 10-watt device so that it'll work for everything from 3-watt needs to 10-watt needs. And they're constantly burning off a watt or two. So, you know,
I'm just saying that what you're describing is a deficiency in the design of the wall wart, not the fact that.
Well, a relatively recent deficiency in the design. The ability for a device to sense load and flip itself on and off cheaply pretty much didn't exist 15 years ago when this technological change happened.
I would disagree with that.
It was pretty much, no, the wall warts back in the day, you cut them open, they were basically just a transformer and a diode, maybe a capacitor.
Well, sure. And the technology to make them clever existed.
It existed, but it was expensive.
30 years ago.
Right, but it was expensive. I mean, your $10 wall wart would have been a $30 wall wart. That technology probably exists now, and it's probably fairly cheap. So let's mandate that. Can we agree on that, Jim?
Well, just make the wall wart not consume any power.
Right, make it smart.
No load on it.
Make it smart, yeah. Okay, I'll go along with that. But let's do it. One or the other. Jim, thanks a lot for the call. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Yes, I was actually licensed once as a broadcast engineer and an electrical engineer. Long ago and far away. Hey, minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you, and just to wrap up our conversation about wall warts, those little lumpy transformer things that plug into the wall and are always on, providing electricity to your whatever it may be. Jeff is on the line from Denver. Jeff, you wanted to weigh in.
Yeah, first I'd just like to make one quick comment on wilderness, then wall warts.
Okay.
On wilderness, we don't want just the uninhabitable land. We want prime land to preserve ecosystems of all kinds. We need to like really promote the Buffalo Commons, bring back migratory routes for buffalo in the plains and such.
Right.
So wilderness needs to represent every aspect of our landscape.
Yeah, I kind of wandered off that topic, didn't I, in that debate? You're absolutely right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And anyway, as far as wall warts, I think today you and I maybe should start the one wart movement, because what's ridiculous is you go to garage sales and you'll see just boxes of wall warts. Everybody has excess wall warts, but they're all the same voltage and amperage. I mean, basically, like, there are three different voltages, but nowadays almost everything is going around the USB standard.
Right.
So I'd like to appeal to cell phone manufacturers and such. Stop including chargers with your phones and all these proprietary plugs, when all we have to do is have a USB plug, and you can just keep on using the same charger forever. And the cell phone manufacturers will make a lot of money because they won't have to include the chargers.
Yeah. Well, it could be that the next standard becomes. I mean, this is certainly the case on airplanes. I was on a plane last week, and there was a 110 outlet, and there was a 5-volt USB outlet. And,
yeah.
You know, it's I can see them starting to wire houses this way with 5-volt, you know, 5 volts at, say, 3 amps, that's 15 watts, that's a fair amount of power, you know. In fact, they might even go to 5 amps, and you could do that. You can run 5 amps through what, probably 18-gauge wire, maybe 20-gauge. It wouldn't have to be very large. And
oh, yeah, it's going to be a much, and in the house, it's going to be a much safer system and actually work much better as solar.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, you're always losing on conversions. You know, you're giving off heat.
Right.
And so besides just them doing nothing, doing something when they're not supposed to be doing anything, so wasting energy to do nothing,
right?
They also waste energy in conversion. So the less conversion we can do, the better.
Yeah, and if everything went to a 5-volt standard, because you can define the output of a solar cell, the individual cells by the size of it, and you know typically they're producing a volt and a fragment, or a fragment of a volt, or 2 volts and a fragment, and you have to series a bunch of them to get up to 6 or 12. Yeah. And you series them to get up to 12 volts, then you parallel them to run your amperage up. And but if everything was to go to 5 volts, people would start building solar cells that would be multiples, you know, of 5 rather than 6, because everything is 6 or 12 because of, you know, 12-volt DC lead-acid batteries.
But there's nobody out there. I imagine there's nobody right now that needs a charger. We all have excess ones. And now all the new phones have the USB. So let's just start using one kind of USB connection, and that's it.
It's a one-world solution. Okay.
One wart.
One wart. A one-wart solution. There you go. Thank you, Jeff, for the call. It's always great to hear from you. Marty in Evergreen Park, Illinois. Hey, Marty, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I just wanted to chime in earlier on your other guest that was speaking about unemployment being another welfare program, and that just kind of grated on my nerves a little bit, because I think oftentimes people forget just how long it takes to get a job. I mean, you have to go on sometimes multiple interviews, only get turned down for a job. Sometimes you have to send in your you have to work like 30 hours a week sometimes just to even land an interview. So, I mean, just to assume that nobody, and part of the unemployment insurance requirements is that you're looking for a job. So, what, if you don't get a job, you lose? I mean, it just doesn't make any sense.
No, I think it's callous, indifferent, and insulting to say something like that, frankly. And here's a statistic that I think is solid. There is something called a natural unemployment rate. It includes basically two things. You've got a certain group of people who basically just don't want to work. You know, they're just never going to want to work. And it's a very small percentage of the population, and probably there's, you know, a screw not quite, you know, they got a screw loose, if you know what I mean. And that's maybe 1%, 1.5%, 2% of the population. And we're always going to have those folks, and we just have to build the cost of them into anything that we do. And then on top of that, you've got another percent or so of people who are in at any snapshot in time. If you look at any one particular day of the year, on that particular day, about, you know, a certain fraction of a percent of people just lost their job, or just got a new job, or just quit a job to take a new job, or are in the process of moving from job to job. And so for a very brief period of time, they are unemployed, but they show up in the statistics. So when you add those two numbers together, what you come up with is what's called a natural unemployment rate, or a baseline unemployment rate. That there's some debate about this in economic circles, what it actually should be here in the United States. But history seems to indicate that it's somewhere just a little south of 3%. When Jimmy Carter lost the election to Ronald Reagan, the unemployment rate in the United States was 3.1%. It was really, really low. We have had times of really boom time employment in the United States. And when you see wages starting to, you know, wages getting bid up, like happened during the dot-com bubble in the early 2000s, you had an unemployment rate that was just right around 3%. So I would submit to you, Marty, that whenever the unemployment rate is above 4%, it is not the fault of the unemployed. And to suggest that it is to insult them. That when the unemployment rate is above 4%, what's going on is that capitalism is failing. There's something wrong with the system. And the rules of the game of capitalism are defined by government. They're defined by tax policy principally, and the largest of the tax policies is trade policy. And so so I would submit that if we were to say whenever unemployment goes above 4%, then the government becomes the employer of last resort, and it becomes imperative that we examine our tax and our trade policies to figure out why our jobs are not here. And it's just really, really simple. And then when unemployment gets below 4%, the government starts laying people off of government jobs, you know, the WPA, CCC, you know, build a bridge working for the government kind of thing, and lets private industry take it over. Making sense, Marty?
Oh, absolutely. And not only that, think about how many more labor hours you'd save just from people having to go through the process of trying to find a job when they can just get one, cut out the,
And think how productive the country would be. Yeah, it's insane how incredibly productive the entire country would instantly become. I mean, right now with a 7% theoretical unemployment rate and an actual unemployment rate that's closer to 14%, we're losing at least 10% of the productive capacity of our country. And what could we be doing with that? We could be solarizing the entire world. I mean, there's amazing stuff we could do with 10% of the productive capacity of the United States. So, Marty, thank you very much for the call. James in Belvedere, Illinois. Hey, James, what's up?
Yeah, I kind of just wanted to add on to that that comment about make work. Your last guest made a comment about, it's just make work. They never work. We got work. It's not make work. Building a bridge or fixing a road or creating water systems, that's not make work. That's an actual job to help commerce, help businesses, help families, building schools. You know, by now in this country, our schools should be sidewalks ought to be paved in gold. Yeah. To be honest with you, it's a
shame. Like I said, we have seen from 2008 to today, this country, the net wealth of the private sector, of the individuals in this country, has increased by $34 trillion. That is $100,000 for every man, woman, and child in this country, that we have gotten richer since 2008. And how much, what was your share of that, James? I mean, I haven't gotten that much richer since 2008.
Yeah, it's like you're going to say, hey, I want to get the desert wet.
Yeah.
But I got a bucket of water. I'm going to go throw it in the desert because I want to get the – no, I'm not going to throw it in the desert. I'm going to throw it in the ocean to get the desert wet.
Yeah.
It's like giving, resources to people that don't need the resources.
No, all that, that $34 trillion went to the top 7% of Americans, and that's it, and it's – anyhow. Thank you for the call. Well said, James. Laurie in Cashiers, North Carolina. Quick comment about antidepressants and medical marijuana, Lori?
Yeah, I just wanted to connect the Affordable Care Act and tell you that through my experience, I was put in a coma. I didn't go into one. I was put into a coma, and the last words I heard before I went under were, "She doesn't have insurance, and so you'll probably never see a dime back."
Whoa.
And you bet those guys never saw a dime back because I kept writing letters and saying, what happened, what happened, what happened? Because the last thoughts I had before going under is this why I'm in critical care? So since then, I've just been, diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder, and doctors keep telling me, it's a depressive disorder. You need to be on antidepressants. And then he finally told me, I said, is this, where medicine is headed? And he said, absolutely, that's where medicine is headed. We would rather depress the population than deal with the individual.
Right, that's a shame. Lori, thanks for the story.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We need to, if we're going to do any fine-tuning on Obamacare, the first thing we need to do is to make sure that it includes medical marijuana. And welcome back. 15 minutes before the hour. And Stefan in Stockholm, Sweden. Hey, Stefan, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, hello, Tom. How are you doing?
I'm well. How about you?
Yeah, sure. As you used to say, I'm fine, but I'm doing better.
Good. Good stuff.
Yeah, I was wondering about the affordable health care, Obamacare.
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't it be in the best interest for the federal government to have a healthy people who can, you know, work or provide jobs and everything that comes along. Yeah, I know you talk about economics, and I've followed it, and the multiplier effect. Wouldn't this be the best opportunity for America to, you know, reinvent what you have in the 40s, 50s, and 60s?
Yeah. So is your point that having a national healthcare system like you have in Stockholm, Sweden, provides for a healthier workforce, and therefore it's an economic boost completely independent of the morality of everybody being able to have healthcare?
Yeah, because if you have a government that, you know, is elected, the elected government is there to provide for the people, to make the country prosper, to make the country good for the people who lives there and people who wants to move in there, you know, to make it a prosperous country. And the government should be there to provide health care. You know, as you say, the commons, that roads should be safe and good, and also, as you say, when the economy, when there's a reset, that the government can provide jobs. So, okay, let's make our roads better, if that's the issue.
Yeah, it's pretty straightforward stuff. I'm with you, Stefan. Good point. Thank you very much for calling and sharing that. Jim, in Schussburg, Massachusetts, you wanted to talk about Russia and the Ukraine?
I do, yes.
You're on the air.
I get off the speakerphone.
Okay. I think Jim got off the speakerphone and he got off the phone. Yeah, Jim, I can't hear you, and we just have 30 seconds to the break, so I'm gonna give you an opportunity to call back, and we'll try and get it on. But the note said that you wanted to talk about the oligarchs in Russia. My one thought on that, and I don't pretend to be an expert on oligarchs in Russia, is that to the best of my knowledge, we haven't put any oligarchs in the United States in jail. We haven't challenged the oligarchs. Our government doesn't stare them down. But in Russia, that has happened. Now, whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, I don't honestly know. I'm not sure how much power I want the government to have. I'm not sure how much power I want the oligarchs to have. But I think that the relationship between the oligarchs and the government is somewhat different in Russia than it is in the United States. But I'd be interested in hearing your thoughts on it. So give us a shout back. And if you don't get through today, there's always tomorrow and the day after and the day after. Thanks a lot. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Okay, Spiffy Dem says USB does not support 5 amps. All right, so I've gone over the top. 4 amps then. 4 amps at 5 volts is 20 watts. You can do a heck of a lot. I got to stop swearing. You could do a heck of a lot with 20 amps. I mean, that you could do a lot with that. And thank you for those comments. Oh, and our Twitter feed is, you know, lots of interesting. Democrats will rue the day that, like Neville Chamberlain, they failed to stand up at any of these points in time. Truth Tweeters does, you know, some pretty good stuff. Thank you for those. Okay, anyhow, back to the phone lines. Mark in Palatine, Illinois. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I had a quick question. Well, I'm reading Prophet's Way, and thank you very much. And I'm curious as to whether there's any relationship to Rudolf Steiner, but I digress.
I can tell you very quickly that there is not. When I met Herr Mueller, he knew who Steiner was through the educational stuff, through the Waldorf schools, but that was pretty much it.
Interesting. Anyway, my question today is proportional legislation. We have proportional representation,
right.
And I'm not smart enough to think this through. Can you help me? What if we had proportional legislation. I can't get back at the knucklehead senators in Oklahoma, and they can affect my well-being, you know, by their legislation.
Right.
What
well,
if we had
the
proportional
way,
legislation?
We sort of have that by the way that the House of Representatives is configured. I mean, you know, you have for roughly every 600,000 people, you have one member of Congress. The Senate, you have two members of Congress for every state. And so the Senate is a much less proportional body. You've got senators representing 11% of America, if I'm remembering my numbers right, who are capable of stopping legislation initiated by, you know, over 70% of senators representing over 70% of America. I think the solution to that, and this is not popular in these states, so it's probably not going to happen, but would be to split California into three states. You split Texas into two states, split Florida into two states.
Maybe Illinois into two.
Maybe Illinois, New York for sure. New York City should split off from the rest of New York State. And if you just did those five that I just named, that would give you seven new states. That would give you 14 new senators, and all of them but probably four would be Democratic. And because Texas, you'd end up with one Democratic senator and it would become one Democratic state and one Republican state. California would probably be three Democratic states, but it's not inconceivable that the far southern California, San Diego area, could be Republican. Florida, I think that you would have, you know, a Democratic and a Republican Florida. And the consequence would be that you'd have a Senate that's much more representative.
Yeah, but, the unintended consequences, and I can't think that. I don't know how to
reason it. I don't know of any unintended consequences. I think that you would be localizing. I mean, when these states were created, well, actually there was some considerable difference in size between Pennsylvania and Rhode Island, for example, in the early days. So, but I think that balancing, redistributing the distribution of the Senate, because that the Senate, that compromise, the small state large state compromise in the beginning, as with so many of the problems in our republic, came not just out of small states being afraid of large states consuming them, but came out of the slave states being concerned that they were not going to have enough representation in the House of Representatives, because only their in the original draft, the original iteration, you read the Madison's debates on the Constitution, only the white citizens were going to be counted. And eventually they said, okay, we're going to count all the white citizens, plus we'll count the black citizens, and we'll count 3/5 of them, for the purposes of determining a member of the House of Representatives. But the southern states still felt like, they weren't getting what they should get. And their populations were relatively low compared to the northern states. So, once again, slavery bites us in the butt. But, there's actually a movement to bring about proportional representation across the United States. And that would be a cool thing. Short of that, of course, instant runoff voting would work. But I'm going to have to – it's been about a year since we had the guy on who's running the organization that's trying to get proportional representation in the states. I'm going to have to get him back on because I can't remember the details of it well enough to explain them. Mark, thank you for the call. Pete in Lake Zurich, Illinois. Hey, Pete, what's up?
Hey, how are you? I wanted to address the issue we were talking before about the chargers. You should use just one standard, and
yeah,
people have them all over the house. I don't think they I think they should continue to give one with each device you buy, and I'll tell you why. You are very knowledgeable on the watts and volts and all that other stuff. I'm not. I'm a layman. I'm always afraid that if I use this charger to charge that device, I'm going to blow it up or something.
Right, and more often than not, you will.
Anything about the electronics. So,
yeah.
I would never take one that I've got laying around and use it for something else.
Yeah, and that's smart.
That it comes with is dead.
But see, what Jeff was suggesting, Pete, was that we create a standard that everybody go to 5 volts DC and say, this is the standard. It's been established as the USB standard. All our computers use it, all the devices that plug into computers, regardless of whether it's an Apple or a Mac or a PC or whatever. It's all 5 volts DC. That we establish that as the standard. And everybody moved to that because our electronic devices are sophisticated enough now that, it used to be that some had to be 9 volts because they had CK722 transistors in them, and you really had to have 9 volts to pop that current past the, past the, from the cathode over to the anode. Now, I mean, everything is sufficiently sensitive that we could standardize at 5 volts with no problem. So, but it's, you know, this kind of also falls into the category if I was king, and I'm not. So, Pete, thanks for the call. You're absolutely right, though. Do not just grab some random charger and plug it in, because there's so many different voltages. Some are AC, some are DC, some are positive tip, some are negative tip, some are, you know, it's crazy stuff. And at that, we will see you tomorrow. We got a great show planned for you. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. It's not a spectator sport. You got to get out there and show up. Hey, and get over to pdamerica.org and sign that petition for Bernie to run for president. Would you? pdamerica.org. Check it out. We'll see you tomorrow. Tag your.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.